There's a planet 200 light years away, and it's the smallest exoplanet ever discovered. From here on Earth, it looks as small as a golf ball seen from 10 million kilometres away. Yet scientists have weighed this planet and measured its mass. To answer the questions why and how, our science correspondent Chris Smith joins us from Cambridge. Chris, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
It's called Kepler-138b, this exoplanet. Tell us more about it.
It's an imaginative name, isn't it? But it's named after NASA's Kepler Space Telescope that was a project deployed between 2009 to 2013. And its mission was to scan something like 150,000 pinpoints of light in the Milky Way galaxy, in other words, stars, in order to try to find evidence of things like these planets. Because what scientists are looking for are little dips in the light from those stars that correspond to something going between us and the star, which can then tell you there might be a planet there. And you can then interpret those dips a little bit more. You can work out how long they last, and that tells you how big the planet's likely to be. You can also, in some cases, see the light from the star changing a little bit because a big planet going around it, exerting a gravitational effect, will tug on the surface of the star and pull it towards us a bit or pull it away from us a bit. And this warps the light very slightly, changing its colour subtly, so we can therefore effectively weigh the mass of the planet. And this is important work because what we don't really understand is how systems like our solar system, with its clutch of inner rocky worlds and then its big gas giants like Jupiter, how do those sorts of systems form? What's their evolution? And if we study other examples of other systems in other parts of our Milky Way galaxy, then we have a good idea, or we have a better chance of developing a good understanding of that process. And what Eric Ford and his colleagues there at Penn State University have published in this paper, Nature This Week, are the findings of this planet, Kepler-138b, which is extremely small. It's the smallest exoplanet, in other words, a planet outside our own solar system orbiting a distant star. It's the smallest planet yet to be established, measured, and in this case weighed effectively. It's about two-thirds the size of Mars, or about 6.7% of the mass of the Earth, and this is too small to detect via the starlight being warped or bent. So what they've done is to look, in fact, at how this tiny dot of light has been influenced by, or it has influenced the behaviour of a clutch of planets, because there are three planets, Kepler B, C and D, that are going around Kepler-138, this distant star, and the way in which they gravitationally affect each other it means that you can measure the presence and infer the presence of these planets and therefore work out how much they weigh, and so now we understand a bit more about this planet that's out there.
Can we see these planets from Earth?
They're too small to see individually, so what we're having to do is to rely on their influence on the star that they're orbiting and on each other. And that's what they've done in this study. You see the light change from the star and you can then infer the presence of the planets. Other less distant planets you can begin to see. The really big ones, we're now beginning to see evidence of the planet for real. We're getting very good telescope techniques now, but on the whole, most of these are indirect measures just based on the effect they have on the light. But why this is important is that it gives us insights into how these planets might have formed, where they came from in these systems, and really their evolution over time, because that then begins to tell us how likely it is that we'll find other systems just like the Earth and the Earth's system here in our solar system, elsewhere out there in the galaxy and possibly even the universe.
And Chris, another how and why question. Scientists have genetically modified mice, allowing them to play back happy or sad memories in their brain. How does that work, and what's to prove?
Well, what Susumu Tunegawa, who's an ex-Nobel laureate, in fact, he got the Nobel Prize a few years ago before switching the area he worked on to look at this neuroscience puzzle. What he's trying to understand with his colleagues at MIT is the basis of depression and how the brain actually becomes depressed and what might be used as a strategy to alleviate depression. And they have some mice, very special mice, in which they have genetically modified them so that they can, when they withdraw the presence of a drug that they give these mice all the time, when the mice have the drug taken away, any nerve cells that are active at that time have a gene transiently turned on that makes a chemical in those cells, making the nerve cells that are active sensitive to light. And what they did with these mice was to use this technique to effectively label up the nerve cells that would contain a certain memory, so that if they then shone light onto those cells using a fibre optic threaded into the mouse brain, they could replay that memory into the mouse mind. And what they did with these mice was they had three groups of them. They had a group that were given a pleasant experience while they did this to them, a group that had a neutral experience, and a group that had an unpleasant experience. So effectively, you've got locked into the mouse brain in a recruitable way and replayable way, a good memory, a neutral memory, or a bad memory. They then subjected these groups of mice to 10 days of chronic stress, which if you do this to mice, you make them depressed. They show the rodent equivalent of depressive symptoms. They don't do things that normal mice would seem to enjoy. They seem to be particularly lacking in motivation and so on. They then subjected these mice that had had the positive experience or the neutral or the negative experience to 5 days of replaying these memories to them of their positive, neutral or negative emotional experience. And then they gave them another stressful experience. And the mice which had had the 5 days of memories that were good replayed to them performed much, much better and showed significant relief of their depressive symptoms that they had been displaying. And this shows that presumably what's happening in the depressed brain is that we normally have recourse to our memories of the good times, which enables us to maintain a perspective and put ourselves in context of whether things are really that bad and not get depressed. And perhaps in the depressed brain, this process is broken and we don't have the same ability to think ourselves happy or think we're contented. And as a result, we tend to become more depressed. And so this is a very interesting opening into understanding how depression perhaps becomes entrenched in the brain.
Indeed, it's also an interesting opening into how you can implant memories, thinking very total recall here. Chris, thank you very much.
Thanks, Fran.
Dr. Chris Smith, Cambridge University virologist. He's our science radio star, of course, and you can catch him tonight here on RN with the Naked Scientists at 10 o'clock.